My father told me that his grandfather never took communion. He went to church every week. He sat in the same pew, but he never took communion. I grew up in this church. I remember standing in the gym at Seymour Christian School, standing in front of my father and receiving a blessing from an elder. I can't say I remember what exactly was said at the communion class I took as a child, but I do remember the difference between standing in front of my parents receiving that blessing and standing beside them and receiving the bread and the wine. I have been taking communion almost every week for almost 20 years. Yet I think that for a long time, I was not very much different than my great-grandfather. When I think about my great-grandfather, whom I never met, my grandfather, a quiet man who worked at a factory his entire life, my own father, who struggled with his body and his mind my entire life. And when I think about myself now, I think that we all struggled with, and I will certainly continue to struggle with, grace. Grace doesn't make sense. If I inherited anything from my father, I inherited at least a bit, a shadow of his logical mind. I want things to make sense. Grace does not make sense. In high school, I wanted religion to make sense. I wanted the people I encountered in church and at my Christian school to live up to the moral codes we profess to adhere to. I was angry at hypocrisy. Though I wouldn't have been able to articulate this at the time, I was angry at myself because I was a hypocrite. And so I struggled with depression and self-loathing. I distanced myself from others, and I distanced myself from God. In college, I worked at a place called Camp Tall Turf with urban low-income kids, a camp focused on racial reconciliation. I encountered an authenticity there that I hadn't ever known before, and I think for the first time realized what worship is. It was amazing, but I struggled to incorporate those summer experiences into the rest of my life. I switched majors to social work and picked up a religion minor. I became passionate about social justice and liberation theology. I still wanted things to make sense, though. I fixated on the Book of James' assertion that faith without works is dead, but forgot that faith is an essential element to that equation. I had abandoned a personal relationship with Jesus, because to me that phrase conjured up nothing but stereotypes of political party affiliation, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness. For my part, I believed in God the Father, a God of justice, and to me that made sense. My father died 5 years ago. That didn't make sense. And in some senses, it put me back at the beginning. I'm thankful for that now. One day I was reading about the Pharisees and realized that I had become one. I was working out my salvation as a logical moral code and way of relating to the world, and was ignoring this God-man Jesus walking around in front of me. I wanted to be right. I wanted to have to earn something. It didn't make sense that I didn't have to. I had searched for God, but in the end, of course, it was God who found me and told me I was being terribly stupid about the whole thing. So for me, the joy of Easter is grace. Jesus loves me. It doesn't make sense. I don't deserve that. But I think for me, the difference is now that thought fills me with freedom and not frustration. The freedom of surrender. As Jack said this morning, Jesus is Lord. And I take comfort that I'm not my own, but belong, body and soul, in life and death, to the risen Christ.
Can you hear me? I've had cancer for a long, long time. Over the past 15 years, I've had two kinds of breast cancer, which is now in my bones, my back, my hips, my left shoulder. I've had non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. I've had that for about 9 years. And I've had acute promyelocytic leukemia, which almost killed me. I'm also divorced. And a year ago in December, after 42 years of marriage, I left my husband. Now, in some ways, those two things are related, but I'll get into that later. In many ways, I say divorce is harder than cancer. Jack alluded to that a few weeks ago when he said, the betrayal is what's so devastating in a marriage that goes wrong. And that's what I experienced over the years, lots and lots of betrayal. But what made cancer easier was all the flowers and the cards and the letters and the phone calls, and people put their arms around me, and I was put on about every prayer chain I could think of. People really, really cared for me. Doctors cared for me, medical people cared for me, friends cared for me, family cared for me. Everybody was on my team. Divorce, however, was a lonely walk. Now, part of that was my fault. I didn't really mention it to too many people when things went wrong in my marriage again. I kind of kept things to myself and suffered in silence. My good friends knew, but how do you tell other people? Oh, my husband has a girlfriend again. Yes, we're in counseling. Yes, we're going through therapy. Even the church, which put him under discipline, was silent about that. So all people knew was my husband wasn't there. He just was gone. But they didn't know anything about the divorce until well after it happened. Then it just became gossip. So in many ways, after the divorce happened, I sunk to an all-time low, far worse than what I ever have with cancer. I think because I missed that prayer support, I missed the community support, I missed people just plain showing that they were walking with me through this trial. Well, I got through cancer by the grace of God, and I got through the divorce. And I'm thinking, in looking back, that what got me through one is getting me through the other. Let me just share some of those things with you. The first thing is, Jesus lives, and so do I. I don't know how people get through cancer without Christ. I don't know how they get through a divorce without Christ. I couldn't have made it through either one. Years before I even had my first bout of cancer, I had a kind of vision, I guess that's what you call it, somewhere between waking and sleeping, and I saw the face of Christ, and it was a look so loving, so caring, so kind, and so accepting that I knew without a shadow of a doubt that I belonged to Christ and that I was his. And I said to my husband the next morning, you know what? I don't doubt it anymore. I belong to Christ. I'm a child of God. And I haven't ever. And that's what's gotten me through many, many hard times. Part of it is Jesus took all my guilt, all my sin, all my shame to the cross. But he didn't stay there. He rose, and he rose in victory. And he showed me how to live, even in the midst of the most horrendous situations, even in the midst of the deepest depression. He showed me I had to live. I have to admit that there was a time during cancer when I didn't want to live anymore. And there was certainly a time when I was going through divorce that I didn't want to live anymore. But each time I just hang on to, you know, like the lady in the Bible who hung on to Jesus, touched Jesus' hem of his garment. She had the incurable blood disease. I felt like I was hanging on for dear life and just kept hanging on. And that's all I could do was hang on. And that is what helped me through. The second thing that helped me through was to realize that Jesus reigns, and so do I. It's hard to believe you're going to get back on top when your body is either covered by adhesions and bandages and you've got tubes dripping everywhere, and when your head is bald and you're so thin, people think you're anorexic, and when your skin is ashen. It's hard to believe you're ever going to get through that, but you do. And I think it's because God has given us such wonderful bodies that yearn with every cell toward healing. That just amazes me, that as sick as you can be, and I was a pretty sick puppy there, especially during leukemia, all my cells wanted to get healthy again. And so with the right kind of treatment and the right kind of support and so on, I did get healthy again. Now, after I was going through divorce and I hit the pit of depression, it was harder to believe I could get back on top. The world grayed out, I call it, kind of turned to ash. I'm a person of color. I love colors, and I didn't see any anymore. I just saw gray. All my relationships had lost their meaning, their focus. I didn't find joy anymore. I couldn't even look at myself anymore because I was sick of looking at myself and my problems. So what I did was what a friend in a program called Divorce Care Recovery advised. She said, why don't you think about this metaphor? She said, imagine you're standing in a woods and it's very dark and you can't see anything around you and you're scared and you don't know the way out and you're very lost. She said, now imagine that you kind of, in looking around, you sense a faint glimmer in the distance. And you look at it closer, and then you begin moving toward it. And as you move toward it, gradually you come out of the woods. The darkness is at your back, and the light is in front of you. And the more you walk toward it, the lighter it becomes until finally the sun is out and it's day. I found that to be true in my own life. The sun, of course, is Christ. Often when we lift ourselves from our own sin, our own pathetic situations, and turn them on Christ, then we can have hope again. Another thing I learned is Jesus lives, and by his grace, he will cleanse my heart in ways. After I had cancer, probably all three kinds, God opened my eyes to the needs of others with cancer. It just seemed like everywhere I looked, there were people with cancer. And then if I didn't know about them, other people would say, hey, did you know so-and-so has cancer? Maybe you ought to talk to her. And that became a kind of ministry for me. In time, I even wrote a book of devotionals, which I've passed on to a lot of people. Well, when I got divorced, I thought that ministry might be over. I was really, really concerned that my effectiveness was shot now that I was single. I found out that wasn't true at all. Rather than narrowing my service to others, it broadened it considerably. Now my eyes are open to a whole new world of hurting people. And they, like me, are struggling to find their way, find their ministry, find their focus in a world of hurt, in a world that shifted all around them. There are no rules for this kind of life after 42 years of marriage. You don't even know who you are anymore, let alone what you're supposed to be doing. And it's very difficult to try to find your way through that. So that's when you need to hang on to that hem and keep moving. And the final thing, well, my attitude has changed too through this whole process. It's hard to be critical of people when you're standing in their own shoes. So I think sometimes when we don't understand why so-and-so and so-and-so is breaking up, sometimes we should just fall on our knees and pray for them and try to be more understanding rather than critical. You know, I've often found that the less people talk about their situation, the more testimony they might have. And just because they don't talk about it doesn't mean that they cause the problem. I was going to say one little thing about my divorce and how it relates to cancer, too. It's somewhere along the line in my journey with this horrendous beast, I thought, why is it that I keep getting cancer? And I did a lot of reading during that time and learned how hurtful stress can be in your life. And then I began wondering, well, I wonder if the stress of dealing with my husband's infidelity might be related to my cancer. So 6 months before my breast cancer came back, I found out my husband was being unfaithful again. And I said to him, I wonder what the effect of this is going to have on my health. Bingo. The cancer came back. This time it was the breast cancer in my bones. And I knew without a doubt that in order to live, I had to leave my husband. That was a really, really difficult thing for me to do. Sometimes it's easier to just go with the flow. But I knew that I couldn't do that before God. I needed to live, and I had to fight to live. So I did that. And the last thing I've learned that is that Jesus lives and that nothing can separate me from him. You know, when you can be riding along just as healthy as can be and all your annual physicals look good and then wham, you get one where the doctor says, you know, I think I feel a lump. I'm not sure, but maybe I ought to have another mammogram. And before you know it, you're on a gurney headed for surgery and 6 months of chemotherapy. Or you feel a little bump in your groin, and your finger keeps going there because you think, that shouldn't be there. And so finally you go to the doctor, and he says, well, we better check it out. And wham, it's non-Hodgkin's lymphoma. Or you go in for a routine blood test for the non-Hodgkin's lymphoma, and your doctor says, your blood tests are all messed up. Maybe you better repeat those. And so you do that, and you find out, wham, you've got leukemia. Well, the same kind of thing can happen with you in marriage. You're riding along just happy as can be, going out for dinner with friends and going on little vacations and enjoying each other's company, going to the store, going shopping and so on, and then wham, you find out he's involved with somebody else. And this time, despite all the counseling, all the church intervention, all the prayers, the marriage is going nowhere. I have learned that nothing, no joy or grief, no pain or sorrow, no cancer or divorce, no powers of hell, nothing can separate me from Christ. I am his. And he is mine, and he wants me to live, and he wants me to rise with him in glory one day and be with him. Christ has died. Christ is risen. Christ will come again. Hallelujah.
What date is it? Is it the 12th? Joe's mentioning his dad died 5 years ago. I thought it's 5 years ago yesterday. We buried my mom. And I hadn't thought of that until he said that. When I graduated from Calvin, the administration didn't think to invite George Bush. So when they asked Nick Walterstorff to speak, he did. I remember his speech was based on John 15, verse 4. Abide in me as I abide in you. He used a wordplay to illustrate. Whereas the pressures of life, of employers, etc., would soon have us living by the refrain, don't just stand there, do something. God, Nick told us, wanted something different from and for us. He wanted us to abide. God says, Nick told us, don't just do something, stand there. For me, this idea has only grown more significant. Throughout my life, grasping my identity has felt like catching rabbits with a salt shaker. And in a world that sees people like us as quaint, as though we were Amish, this idea of abiding has been helpful for me. Call me quaint, but whatever encouragement or comfort I have offered others, whatever encouragement I offer myself, these are rooted in the idea of abiding, rooted in the resurrection of Jesus Christ from the dead. Abide in me as I abide in you. That's what Jesus said. I understand this to be an attitude of the soul, deciding through doubt to believe that God is near, and with no preconditions or expectations, to reciprocate nearness as a means and an end of expressing love. Abiding is loving. C.S. Lewis captured this when he said, I believe in Christianity as I believe that the sun has risen, not only because I see it, but because by it I see everything else. I've tried to do this. When I became a father, I think I may have observed resurrection's primary color. It's pink. I saw it on July 2, 1987 at 5:40 a.m. with the birth of my first son, Henry. He was born cesarean, and as I was standing about 15 feet away, bright lights illumined his coming forth. First feet, legs, long, skinny, and blue, thighs and buns coated green with in utero poo, a penis, a little pot belly, tiny little arms and hands with fingers, a face, a coned head, ears, and red hair. I have to say, I did not anticipate that my firstborn would be green, blue, and red. A nurse brought him right next to me to a table equipped with a heat lamp. I studied him as she wiped goo and reached for a suction tool. In addition to the aforementioned colors, his eyes were shut and he was not breathing. But then, as she drew out fluid from his nose, wind reached his lungs, and in that instant, he pinked. I thought to myself, resurrection looks like this. Abiding is not a means to illumine just the good. For by it, we see everything else, the good, the bad, the ugly. The summer of 1986, I fell in love with a girl who lived just up the street, the most beautiful girl, 9 years old, named Anne. Affable, bright, cheerful dimples, long curly blonde hair, and lovely blue eyes. Anne had a brain tumor. Her dad and I were old friends. I helped him paint their house that summer. I remember painting her bedroom window late one August evening. There we were, peering at each other through the window, two stories up, Romeo and Juliet. Leaning on her nightgown-clad elbows, she found my paint-speckled face and perch outside her bedroom ever so amusing. "Now what are you doing?" she'd say over and again. And no matter what I replied, she giggled. "I'm painting the sash," giggle. And then, of course, when I took the brush and painted a goatee and mustache on myself, she fell straight backwards onto the bed, reeling with laughter. When she returned and I painted my nose, she fell back again, bounced, and landed on the floor, where giggle became guffaw. I was fully prepared to coat my whole head, but there was no need. She never returned to the window. She just laughed to infinity and beyond until her mother came in and put her under the covers. Other evenings, I came by and we'd play Yahtzee while she lay on the couch. It was such great fun. The whole community prayed for that girl. I got down on my knees nightly and faced her house and begged for her life. The first Sunday evening in October, outside smoking a cigarette, I looked up the street and saw the ambulance in the driveway. She died in her father's arms. Last month, a 21-year-old man named Dominique Farr was arrested in Grand Rapids, charged with the March 20 murder of Tori Goodwin, a 34-year-old man a father of four, a man described as Mr. Mom. Through the 10th grade, Dominique Farr was Henry's classmate and friend at Christian High. He left abruptly when his parents didn't feel it was worth the money as his grades continued to fall. I have videos of Dominique, number 66, bowling his way into the Cedar Springs end zone like a junior refrigerator Perry, taking four little peewee tacklers on his back for a ride and subsequently high-fiving Henry. I used to bring him home from practice now and then. He lived on Evergreen near Eastern. He was a big clown who worked at Wendy's. When he'd see us coming through the drive-thru, he'd stuff our five-piece chicken nugget box with 11 or 14. Dominique was fun. I felt comfortable with Henry and him being friends. I had forgotten about him until his mugshot appeared in the Grand Rapids Press. When we learn of someone like Dominique or lose someone like Anne, how do we connect the dots and not come up with despair? After what he's done, how will Dominique ever dance again like he did in that Cedar Springs end zone? What do you say to anyone who has the reasonable sense that God is detached and silent? For me, the answer has been Nick's one word to our class: abide. At the age of 9, when my favorite uncle died, I discovered a crazy little thing called grief. Since then, I've learned nobody gets through unscathed. We all are in for a world of hurt. We all suffer. But Nick's word has been a word that I could take with me. Abide supplies air and light. It keeps the dim places from snuffing cold and illumines the mundane to reveal the glorious, such as Henry's first breath. And for that, abide gets credit for moments of pure elation, for moments when I see the chief end of us all is to enjoy God forever. If that doesn't sound all that appealing, insert the words party with for enjoy, until such time as your hormones settle down. As for me, I'll be meeting him down at the hookah lounge later. So, while I do not see the road ahead of me, not with clarity anyway, and I cannot begin to know where life will take me, and I still don't really know myself, and while I am trying to do God's will, it's a fact that trying does not mean I'm actually doing. Nonetheless, I will trust that he will help me discern the right path. I hope that as I grow older, I will have this desire in all that I do. I may at times seem lost, and it's a sure thing death eventually will come to me and to people I do not want to lose. But I will abide. I will not fear evil, for he lives, and his spirit is ever with me, and will never leave me exposed to face the world, to face its perils alone. So, finally, listen to this. If your begetters spoke Dutch, now you choke in the clutch. If the progeny of Jews, now you're singing the blues. If your mama was African, now it seems you'll not laugh again. Then take it from Dick, who heard it from Nick. Don't just do something. Stand there.